Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rundle, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, veterans and some active duty soldiers who served in Iraq and Afghanistan gathered in Maryland this month for Winter Soldier, offering harrowing and often heartbreaking testimony about their experiences in war. The remarkable event elicited next to no corporate media coverage. FAIR founder Jeff Cohen will join us to share his thoughts. Also on Counterspin today, the Supreme Court is hearing arguments in a case challenging Washington, D.C.'s handgun ban. Conservative and liberal legal experts appearing in the media seem increasingly to agree that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to own guns. We'll discuss the Second Amendment debate with Carl Bogus, a law professor at Roger Williams University. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
You'd expect the media to make note of the fifth anniversary of the start of the Iraq War. The way some outlets did so was illuminating. The New York Times' March 16th Week in Review section gathered nine people that the paper dubbed experts on military and foreign affairs to look back at how things have gone so far. But the list of contributors was entirely made up of people who supported the war. So Times readers got three writers from the neocon think tank American Enterprise Institute, liberal hawk Ken Pollock of the Brookings Institute, who was a fixture in the media's pre-war frenzy, three military officials who were part of the invasion and occupation, a Princeton academic who argued in the Times in favor of the Bush strategy of snubbing the UN, and one military expert who expressed misgivings about the planning for the war but supported it nonetheless. No bona fide critics of the Iraq War were invited. According to Danielle Pletka of the American Enterprise Institute, quote, "The mantra of the anti-war left, Bush lied, people died, so dominates the debate about the run-up to the Iraq War that it has obscured real issues that deserve examination," close quote. Apparently, the Times had to counter the overwhelming dominance of the anti-war left in the media. In a separate piece for the Times, reporter John Burns wrote that only the most prescient could have predicted the Iraq War would be a debacle. This is likely a common idea in the corporate media, since it gives them cover for ignoring such critics in the first place. Thus, the discussion of a war entering its sixth year is dominated by people who thought it was a good idea. Does that make any sense to anyone?
Corporate media's coverage of the U.S. financial crisis is some of the most lopsided there is, as a recent Washington Post story illustrates. Crises of confidence in the markets, the Post March 18th front pager, included the following sources: George W. Bush, Richard Bernstein, chief investment strategist for Merrill Lynch, William Beach, senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, Michael McCarty, an options strategist at Meridian Equity Partners in New York, and Daniel J. Mitchell, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Officials, insiders, or conservative critics whose only concern was that bailouts of private investment houses disturbed the pure functioning of the market. Not exactly a rainbow of perspectives, which explains why the story's lone, somewhat challenging statement, quote, "But critics accused Bush of bailing out big Wall Street firms while ignoring ordinary homeowners," close quote, goes unelaborated. What's also funny in a bad way about the big media's coverage of the housing bubble is that, as economist Dean Baker has pointed out, like analysis of the Iraq War, it's dominated by experts who got it wrong. In this case, failing to predict the bubble or even to notice as it grew to $8 trillion before their eyes. One such expert appeared in the New York Times on March 17th, stating that everybody missed the significance or size of the housing bubble. That claim is patently false, unless you define everyone to mean everyone deeply invested in saying the problem would pass, or everyone cited as an expert in the corporate press.
NPR anchor Scott Simon introduced a segment on March 15th about the Iraq War anniversary with this, quote, "Estimates on the number of Iraqis killed range from 47,000 to 151,000, depending on the source," close quote. But what sources are those? The New England Journal of Medicine for January 31st has a write-up of a survey conducted by the Iraqi government for the World Health Organization, estimating that 151,000 Iraqis had died by violence between the invasion and June 2006. So there's NPR's top figure, 151,000. The journal cited estimates from 47,000 from Iraq body count to 600,000 from a Johns Hopkins national survey. So that would also be the source of NPR's lower range number, 47,000, though it's outdated. The current estimate from Iraq Body Count, which tabulates only civilian deaths by violence documented in Western news reports, says that there have been at least 82,000 such deaths. Why didn't NPR use that number? And why, citing a range of estimates from various sources, does NPR ignore the 600,000 estimate? That study, too, only goes up to June 2006, and therefore leaves out the worst of the violence in Iraq. The most recent survey of Iraq deaths is the poll conducted by Opinion Research Business, a top British polling firm, conducted in August 2007. They found an estimated 1.2 million deaths by violence among Iraqi households. But apparently such numbers are too big for NPR to share with its audience.
On March 16th, New York Times correspondent and former Baghdad bureau chief John Burns wrote a long piece looking back on the Iraq War. But the problems start even before the headline, with a photo caption about how the war began with a mesmerizing display of American might, and continue with a reference to, quote, a reduction in violence in the last year that can be traced to the American troop increase, close quote. Then there's Burns, who suggested in April 2003 that he could read Iraqi minds, who reasserts in the text of the piece his insight into the Iraqi psyche. Quote, opinion polls, including those commissioned by the American command, have long suggested that a majority of Iraqis would like American troops withdrawn. But another lesson to be drawn from Saddam Hussein's years is that any attempt to measure opinion in Iraq is fatally skewed by intimidation. My own experience, invariably, was that Iraqis I met who felt secure enough to speak with candor had an overwhelming desire to see American troops remain long enough to restore stability, close quote. In other words, according to Burns, believing polls of Iraqis is crazy. You should just trust what John Burns is hearing from the, no doubt, scientific sample of Iraqis he talks to.
And finally, presumptive GOP presidential candidate John McCain was marking the fifth anniversary of the Iraq War by traveling to the Middle East in the hopes that appearing next to various world leaders would grant him a sort of presidential aura. As the media like to tell us, McCain's a foreign policy and national security pro, so going to Iraq naturally plays to his strengths, except when it doesn't. Speaking to reporters on March 18th, McCain charged that Iran was meddling in Iraq, we've heard this one many times before, by training al-Qaeda in Iraq militants. Well, we haven't heard that one. McCain was gently corrected by his traveling partner Joe Lieberman, and the press was left to figure out what to do with this problem. The Washington Post and New York Times ran stories about McCain's bogus attempt to link the Shiite Iran to the militantly Sunni al-Qaeda, but it got very little play on the network newscasts. Apparently, they considered McCain's trip newsworthy, but not as newsworthy when he told Dick Cheney-style whoppers. Some cable outlets spent more time on the story, CNN's Jack Cafferty and MSNBC's Keith Olbermann, for example, while Fox News Channel said that McCain simply misspoke. That's odd, since McCain had advanced the same falsehood three times, twice in the press conference and once the day before on a talk show. NBC political director Chuck Todd offered a revealing explanation, saying that the media's gentle touch on this showed, quote, how much of the foreign policy experience stuff he's got in the bank, because had Clinton or Obama done something like this, this would have been played on a loop over and over, close quote. We'll take him at his word on that.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show.
The recent Winter Soldier event in Maryland brought firsthand accounts of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars home to the United States in dramatic fashion. Veterans, parents, and some active duty military personnel told stories of atrocities, post-traumatic stress, suicide, and the frustrations of being duty-bound to occupy a country whose citizens want you out. Despite the oft-repeated mantra of supporting the troops, very little of this made it into the American media and onto American television sets. Joining us to talk about the coverage of Winter Soldier 2008 and Winter Soldier 1971 is Jeff Cohen, FAIR's founder, author of the book Cable News Confidential, and the founding director of Ithaca College's Park Center for Independent Media. Jeff, welcome back to Counterspin.
Great to be with you.
Now, Winter Soldier seemed to have all the elements one would require for media coverage. It was dramatic, emotional, it was even visual. Soldiers and vets occupy this special place in our political debate over any war, really. The media is full of these look back at the anniversary of the invasion features, and yet the media's reaction to this Winter Soldier was pretty close to nothing.
It was a near total lockout. It was quite an amazing thing, as you say. I've worked in television news. It had everything you would want in terms of a powerful visual statement. And the interesting thing this time compared to 1971 in Detroit, I was at the first Winter Soldier hearings about Vietnam with Vietnam veterans. This one, so many of the soldiers had brought with them photographs and were presenting visually footage and photographs that they had taken on the ground. This was a near total lockout. There's no other way to explain what happened this last week besides calling it censorship. Everyone knew that these events were happening. The Institute for Public Accuracy sent out a news release to thousands of mainstream journalists, and the decisions were made pretty broadly through mainstream U.S. media. We have to emphasize that because it got big coverage in mainstream media of countries across the globe, except in the United States. So it was a near total blackout. I saw no mention of this in the New York Times. I saw the Washington Post treat it primarily as a local story, and when it made it to the Section A, the pro-war vets, the minority that were had some sort of counter-protest, they were the featured people. Again, this was stunning, a stunning news story that mainstream media consumers did not know about. They could not learn about it. And as you say, in our political culture, soldiers and vets seem to at least purport to have an exalted status. But these particular Iraq vets against the war were locked out. And I think that the key reason is you have a mainstream media today that is trying to justify its near total failure 5 years ago. And for them to actually focus on what's happening on the ground would undermine what they've been saying about how the situation in Iraq is improving and the surge is improving things. And there's no more, if you were looking for who really has the information of what's going on the ground, there's no one you would want to talk to more than soldiers who were there recently. Some of these soldiers that testified in Washington that past weekend, they'd done more than one tour of duty in Iraq. They know the facts on the ground, but they weren't allowed to discuss the facts on the ground to a mass audience. Thank God we had independent media there.
Yeah, we should get to that. But first, you know, I wanted to ask you about the silence or near silence from official Washington. I was probably, like most people, doing these Google searches or looking in the Nexus database for some pickup of this. And you saw one story on Fox News Channel. I thought, oh, well, Fox has done something. Well, what they did was have someone ask John Kerry about Winter Soldier 2008. And he said he didn't know that it was happening. So you did have this sense that even the Democrats in Washington, who professed to want to do something about ending the war, didn't want to touch this event at all. You mentioned independent media. That was the way that people were getting any sense of what was going on. Who was doing it, and what were we hearing or seeing?
Well, let me address that first part, that you're right, with the Democrats not showing up, I guess, except for Congressman Kucinich, because official media, corporate media, make decisions on what's a news story so heavily based on what are the leaders of the two parties saying. and the leadership of the two parties were not talking about Winter Soldier, and it was seen as sort of outside the pale. It was beyond the pale for corporate media. The good news is, and remember, I was at the first Winter Soldier in Detroit, where there was also a near total mainstream media blackout of that incredible event of Vietnam veterans. And in Detroit, I remember, and there, again, room full of weeping people, soldiers pouring their hearts out about Vietnam and the atrocities they'd seen, exactly as happened a week ago about Iraq. The difference is that in Detroit, we didn't have these new communications technologies in 1971 with the Vietnam vets. And we didn't have national network like Pacifica Radio plugged into dozens of affiliates. So what happened this last week with Winter Soldier 2 on Iraq and Afghanistan is, and I listened to it all weekend or watched it, and I was nowhere near Washington, D.C. And, you know, you could go online on the IVAW.org website, which still has the information archived, all weekend long, and you could watch this dramatic media event happening outside of corporate mainstream media. Or the Real News Network was giving feeds every few hours from Washington with the Iraq veterans testifying. As I said, Pacifica Radio, thanks to KPFA. And you had a Free Speech TV was doing broadcast hosted by Laura Flanders and others. So what you had was a huge news story happening. And unlike in 1971, before this communications revolution, before the big power and the networking of independent media had really happened, this time, while there was the same old from the corporate media in terms of censoring the vets, for that minority lucky enough to be plugged in and to know where to look, this was a dramatic media story brought into their living rooms and into their car radios by independent media.
It sounds like what you're saying then is mainstream media 71 and 2008 are pretty much the same, but there is this, you know, I hate to call it a silver lining, but there is this silver lining now, and that the thing isn't just going to drop down into the memory hole.
Well, it's more than a silver lining because, you know, it was hard for the Vietnam veterans against the war with Winter Soldier 1 in 1971 in Detroit to get much traction. It was in a few what were called underground papers. A documentary was made, and that came out way later. This event, while it was blacked out by the corporate media, it's so easy now to take people to it online because of the archives with video and radio, audio archives. We're in a much stronger position here to break a mainstream media embargo or blockade because of the power of independent media and the rise of the internet. It's a huge difference in a few decades, a massive difference.
We've been speaking with Jeff Cohen. He's the founder of FAIR and the founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College. Jeff, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
On March 18th, the Supreme Court began hearing arguments on a case challenging a District of Columbia law outlawing handgun ownership. At the core of the debate is the question of whether the right of the people to keep and bear arms belongs to individuals or whether it is a collective right intended to protect the power of states to field militias. Though many legal experts embrace the collective right view, media discussion of the issue seems to be moving in the opposite direction, where even many liberal commentators frequently take the individual right view. Joining us now to discuss the Second Amendment is Carl T. Bogus. He's a law professor at Roger Williams University and the editor of The Second Amendment in Law and History, Historians and Constitutional Scholars on the Right to Bear Arms. Welcome to Counterspin, Professor Carl Bogus.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, let's begin with what's before the court. Tell us briefly what's at stake here.
Well, what is at stake immediately is the District of Columbia's 1976 law that effectively bans private handgun ownership within the District of Columbia. So this law has been around for a long time, since 1976, has been studied by researchers who have determined that it lowered homicides within the district, that is firearm-related homicides, within the district by 25%. and firearm-related suicides within the district by 23%. The lower courts have declared that that law violates the Second Amendment to the Constitution and is therefore unconstitutional.
And what are the, how are the arguments and the questions from the justices going in your sense? What are you getting from that?
Well, as I count them, and it's somewhat precarious to judge judges by their questions at oral argument. Nevertheless, we do try to read the tea leaves, and my reading is that six of the nine justices appear to be tending toward the individual rights rather than the collective rights view.
And tell us about what's the linguistic debate here.
Well, the Second Amendment, of course, says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The collective rights view says this is all about the right of the people to keep and bear arms within the government-regulated militia, the militia that is actually defined in the main body of the Constitution and is under joint federal and state control. And the amendment applies, therefore, only to the possession and use of arms by members of the militia. The individual rights view tends to say that the preamble does not control the rest of the amendment and that the amendment guarantees a right of individuals to keep and bear arms for their own purposes, self-defense, hunting, or, and this is kind of the most ominous rationale offered, it's been put forward by both the plaintiff, Heller, and by the lower court, the right of the people to have arms in the event the federal government becomes tyrannical and they need to go to war with their own government, often called an insurrectionist right.
Conservative legal scholars have traditionally supported the individual right view of the Second Amendment, but now liberal legal scholars supporting the same view have become much more prevalent, at least in media discussions. Does this indicate an emerging consensus among legal scholars in support of the individual right view?
No, I think that the collective rights view, which, by the way, was the unanimous view among legal scholars from the time that law reviews were indexed in the late 19th century until 1960. So the collective rights view was traditionally a unanimous view, and then gun rights groups stimulated through a sustained and deliberate and well-funded campaign, writing, advocating an individual rights view. And then several prominent liberal scholars, including, for example, Lawrence Tribe at Harvard, Akil Amar at Yale, Sanford Levinson at Texas, and most recently, Erwin Chemerinsky at Duke, signed on to the individual rights position. But at least as many scholars and liberal scholars still endorse the collective rights view.
You were just talking about that insurrectionist interpretation of the Second Amendment. But one interpretation of the Second Amendment is that it wasn't primarily about guns, but about ensuring states' rights to field militias.
Yes.
This has been discussed in several of these sort of explainer articles we've seen explaining the history of the debate. But you refer in a March 18th op-ed in the Washington Times to the fact that Southern slave states were pressing for these independent militias for suppressing potential slave rebellions. Can you tell us why you think that bears mentioning in today's debate?
When the Constitution was ratified, it gave for the first time the lion's share of authority over the militia to the national government. Previously, the state governments had exclusive control over the militia. And it gave the federal government, Congress, the power to organize the militia and to arm the militia. In the ratification debates, some anti-federalists, particularly Southern anti-federalists, argued that this would give Congress the power to disarm the militia, since Congress had been given the exclusive authority to arm the militia, and that Congress might disarm the militia either through neglect or deliberately, because Northern delegates would seek to undermine the slave system, and the slave system depended for slave control on the Southern militia. So this became part of the debate over ratification of the Constitution, particularly in Virginia, where Patrick Henry and George Mason basically accused James Madison of making this mistake in the Constitution. And some of us believe that when Madison went off to the first Congress and wrote the Bill of Rights, in the Second Amendment, he was attempting to fix that problem. That is, if Congress did not arm the militia, then the militia could be armed by the states or by the people themselves. By the way, that's the way it was really done at the time. States merely enacted statutes requiring militia members to bring weapons with them. If that is the correct reading, as I think it is and many other scholars think it is, then the Second Amendment provides, in essence, states a minimum right to arm militia to provide for their own security, and has nothing whatever to do with privately owned guns.
Well, finally, the larger debate about gun control had been somewhat muted in the media before this Supreme Court case, partly because journalists too often take their cues from politicians, and many Democratic politicians who've traditionally been supporters of gun control have been steering clear of the issue as something of a political minefield. On February 8th, this prompted ABC World News anchor Charles Gibson to declare that, quote, gun control advocates are now mostly silent, close quote. But was that really the case, or was it really a matter of a lack of media attention to these advocates?
I think there's an interrelationship between the two. The conventional wisdom among both politicians and journalists has been that gun control is a loser for politicians advocating gun control. As a result, very few politicians have been doing that. Gun control has not really been a major political issue, at least at the national level, for a long, long time.
We've been speaking with Carl T. Bogus. He's a professor of law at Roger Williams University and editor of The Second Amendment in Law and History, Historians and Constitutional Scholars on the Right to Bear Arms. Professor Carl Bogus, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the media watch group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bimonthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure to tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. You can also listen to Counterspin at FAIR's website at www.fair.org. This show was engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.